A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what parents of 10-month-old boys can expect developmentally in the 10 to 12-month window. The CDC's updated milestone data just showed a 14% jump in parents reporting concerns about their 12-month-olds not walking yet. Social media comparison culture is doing a number on parental anxiety right now.
That anxiety lands differently depending on who's asking. Parents of boys specifically. There's this weird cultural assumption that boys should hit motor milestones early, and when they don't, it's somehow a double failure. But the 10-month mark is genuinely a phase transition. The brain is reorganizing itself at the circuit level.
The infant stops being a passive consumer of the world and becomes an active agent of chaos, which is exactly what the parents are living through while they're scrolling Instagram at 2 in the morning seeing someone else's kid allegedly running a half marathon.
That's the tension we're going to dig into. The gap between what the neuroscience actually tells us is happening in this 8-week window, and the distorted version parents absorb from highlight reels. The cerebellum triples its synaptic density. The motor system is running what roboticists would call an internal model calibration, randomized movements that get reinforced by successful outcomes. The language operating system is booting up. And all of this is happening on a developmental schedule with enormous normal variation, but parents are being fed this message that if their kid isn't checking every box by the exact month marker, something's wrong.
We should flag the gender angle up front, because there's a fine line between describing average differences and reinforcing stereotypes. The meta-analyses show boys are about 3 to 4 weeks ahead on gross motor milestones at this stage, and 4 to 6 weeks behind on language. But the variance within each sex is larger than the variance between sexes. You can't look at any individual kid and say anything meaningful based on gender alone.
What you can do is understand the mechanisms. What's actually happening in the brain and body during this window, why certain behaviors emerge when they do, and what the range of normal actually looks like. Motor, language, social cognition, the sleep regression that nobody warns you about, all of it.
Where do we start? The motor explosion seems like the most visible piece, but you mentioned the cerebellum tripling its synaptic density, and that feels like the real story.
The cerebellum between 9 and 12 months is undergoing massive synaptic proliferation, tripling the density. And the cerebellum is not just about balance and coordination, it's also about prediction. It builds internal models of how the body interacts with the physical world. So when a 10-month-old is pulling up on the coffee table for the 40th time, falling, pulling up again, they're not just practicing standing. They're training a prediction engine.
The motor system is running its own beta test. A lot of trial, a lot of error, and a lot of silent updates happening during naps.
The nap part is not a joke. We'll get to sleep consolidation later. But the key concept is motor babbling. Just as infants babble phonetically, producing sounds and seeing what works, the motor system does the same thing. Randomized movement patterns get generated, and when one produces a successful outcome, reaching a toy, pulling up successfully, the brain reinforces that pattern. The unsuccessful ones get pruned. It's a Darwinian process in the motor cortex.
The falling is not failure. The falling is data collection.
This is where parental anxiety gets counterproductive. If you're constantly intervening to prevent falls, you're starving the internal model of the error signals it needs to calibrate. I'm not saying let the kid tumble off the couch. Safety is non-negotiable. But there's a difference between dangerous falls and the controlled wobbles during cruising. Those wobbles are the system learning.
The furniture surfer. The kid who circles the coffee table for 20 minutes but refuses to let go and take an independent step. What's happening there?
That's a vestibular calibration strategy. The inner ear's balance mechanism is getting flooded with new data every time the kid's head position changes during cruising. The brain needs to integrate that with visual input and proprioception, the body's sense of where its limbs are in space. Letting go means trusting that integration has reached a reliable enough state. Some kids need more calibration time. It's not fear in the psychological sense. It's the brain being appropriately cautious about a system still coming online.
Which makes the just let go, buddy. Coaching about as useful as telling a computer mid-boot to hurry up.
And this connects to why some babies skip crawling entirely. About 4 to 7% of infants go straight from sitting to pulling up to walking, with no hands and knees crawling phase. For a long time, there was a folk belief that skipping crawling was a red flag. The data doesn't support that. These infants often use alternative locomotion strategies, bottom scooting, rolling, or the bear walk on hands and feet instead of hands and knees.
The bear walk. That's the one that looks like a tiny CrossFit workout.
It emerges around 10 and a half months in about 68% of boys who use it as a transitional strategy. There's a biomechanical reason boys are slightly more likely to do this. Male infants tend to have a slightly higher center of mass relative to limb proportions, while female infants have a wider hip structure that makes the traditional hands and knees crawl more mechanically efficient. We're talking millimeters in hip width, but they cascade into different movement strategies.
The sex difference in gross motor timing isn't vague biological hand-waving. There's actual biomechanics behind it.
Again, these are population averages. Your individual kid might be a boy who crawls at 6 months and walks at 9, or a boy who scoots until 14 months and then stands up and walks across the room. Both are normal. The range for independent walking is 9 to 18 months, with 50% walking by 12 months. That means half of all infants are not walking at their first birthday. It's not a delay, it's the median.
The long-term outcomes should diffuse the anxiety. The Alice Pack Cohort Study. The Avon Longitudinal Study of Parents and Children, huge dataset out of the UK, looked at this in 2023. Early walkers, defined as walking before 11 months, show no long-term advantage in athletic ability or cognitive outcomes compared to kids who walk at 15 or 16 months.
The correlation evaporates entirely by school age, and yet parents are treating the 12-month mark like a deadline. That 14% increase in CDC concern, that's not driven by actual developmental problems. That's driven by social media feeds full of 11-month-old first steps and everyone else thinking their kid is behind.
Nobody posts the video of their 14-month-old still happily scooting along while the pediatrician says, completely normal.
The pediatrician part matters because the CDC updated their milestone checklists in 2024. Instead of framing milestones as most children do X by Y age, which made the 50th percentile look like a deadline, they now frame them as by this age, 75% of children do X. The bar is set at what most kids have already achieved, not what half are still working on. It's a subtle reframing meant to reduce exactly this anxiety.
Move the goalposts to where the anxiety decreases rather than increases.
It aligns with what the WHO Multicenter Growth Reference Study has been saying since 2006. Updated in 2023, the windows are wide for a reason. Human development is not a race. It's a negotiation between genetics, environment, and the individual brain's own timeline.
Let's get into the mechanics of those first steps. Parents imagine it as a binary switch. One day the kid can't walk, the next day they can. But what's actually happening in the weeks leading up to it?
It's a gradual integration of multiple subsystems. You've got the postural control system, trunk and core stability. You've got locomotor pattern generators in the spinal cord, neural circuits that produce rhythmic stepping movements present from birth. If you hold a newborn upright with feet on the surface, they'll make stepping motions. That reflex disappears around 2 months, but the circuits don't go away. They get reintegrated under voluntary control around the 10 to 12 month mark.
The walking program isn't installed at 10 months. It's been there the whole time, but the brain needs to figure out how to run it consciously.
The piece that takes the longest is balance, the ability to stand on one foot for the split second required to swing the other foot forward. That's not a leg strength problem, it's a vestibular and cerebellar integration problem. The brain needs to build a predictive model of how the body's center of mass shifts during weight transfer. That's what all the cruising is doing. Training that model in a slightly more stable context before the kid has to do it unsupported.
The kid who cruises for 6 weeks before taking an independent step isn't delayed. They're thorough.
They're running extra calibration cycles, and there's evidence that kids who cruise longer have fewer falling accidents in the first month of independent walking. They've built a more robust internal model before going solo.
Which brings us to the pincer grasp, the fine motor side of this window. While the legs are figuring out locomotion, the hands are going through their own quiet revolution.
The pincer grasp refinement is neurologically enormous. Between 10 and 12 months, the corticospinal tract, the main highway of motor neurons from the motor cortex to the spinal cord, undergoes significant myelination. Myelin is the fatty insulation around nerve fibers that speeds up signal transmission. When that tract gets myelinated, precision control of individual fingers becomes possible. Before this, the infant grasps with the whole hand, the palmar or ulnar grasp. The transition to the pincer grasp requires isolating thumb and forefinger and controlling force precisely enough to pick up a Cheerio without crushing it.
The Cheerio test. The universal developmental assessment that happens at every high chair in America.
It's a legitimate marker. If a 10-month-old can pick up a small object using the pads of thumb and index finger without stabilizing against the table, that's the radial digital grasp. It means corticospinal myelination has reached a certain threshold. If they're still raking the object into the palm, that's the ulnar grasp, and it typically transitions between 9 and 11 months.
This is where the evolutionary trade-offs get visible. You mentioned chimpanzee infants walk at 5 months but never develop the same precision grip.
Chimpanzee infants are motorically precocious. They cling to mothers within hours of birth, walk independently around 5 months, but they never develop a true precision grip. Their thumb is shorter and less opposable. The human hand sacrificed early motor competence for later precision. The same trade-off shows up in brain development. We're born with underdeveloped brains relative to other primates, which is why human infants are so helpless for so long. But that extended postnatal development is what allows for the massive cortical expansion that gives us language, abstract reasoning, and fine motor control.
The 10-month-old who can't walk yet but can delicately extract a single pea from a pile is demonstrating the human evolutionary strategy in action.
The brain is prioritizing different systems at different times, and the sequence is not arbitrary. Motor control develops proximal to distal, trunk first, then shoulders and hips, then elbows and knees, then wrists and ankles, then fingers and toes. Fine motor and gross motor run on parallel tracks with different timelines.
Alright, so we've covered the motor system. But while the body is learning to navigate space, the brain is also running another critical update, the language operating system. And this is where the gender difference flips.
The two systems are not independent. The cerebellum, which we talked about for motor learning, is also involved in language processing. The basal ganglia, which handle motor sequencing, are critical for speech sequencing. So when the motor system is consuming a lot of neural resources during this 10 to 12 month explosion, there may be a temporary trade-off with language production.
Which would explain why the boy physically launching himself off the furniture at 11 months might have 3 words while his same-age female cousin has 8. The brain is allocating resources differently, not failing to develop language.
That's what the data suggests. I want to be careful here because the boys talk later narrative has been weaponized in unhelpful ways. It's not that boys are deficient. It's that the developmental sequence prioritizes different systems at different times, and the variance within each sex is enormous.
When parents of boys report more frustration around communication in this window, and they do, that's a consistent finding. What's actually going on?
It's a mismatch problem. The 10 to 12 month old boy is often physically capable of getting what he wants, cruising to the bookshelf, reaching the forbidden object, but he doesn't yet have the verbal tools to negotiate access. He's got agency without vocabulary. That's a recipe for frustration on both sides.
The body is running at toddler speed while the language system is still in beta.
The parent is interpreting the behavior through an adult lens. The kid who climbs the couch and screams when removed isn't being defiant. He's got a fully operational motor system and a pre-verbal communication system. He's not withholding words. He doesn't have them yet.
Let's zoom out and frame this whole window properly. You called it a phase transition earlier. What do you mean?
In dynamical systems theory, a phase transition is when a system reorganizes into a qualitatively different state. Water to ice, same molecules, completely different behavior. The 10 to 12 month window is the human brain's phase transition from passive to active. Before this, the infant is largely a receiver, absorbing sensory input, building representations, forming attachment. At around 10 months, the system tips. Existing neural circuits get pruned and rewired for goal-directed behavior. The baby stops being an audience and becomes an agent.
The pruning part is key. People imagine development as accumulation. The brain just keeps adding connections. But it's actually a subtractive process at this stage.
Synaptic overproduction followed by selective elimination. The infant brain generates far more connections than it needs in the first year. Then around this window, it starts aggressively pruning the ones that aren't being used. It's use it or lose it. Circuits reinforced through experience survive. The ones that don't get trimmed away. This is why environment matters so much. The brain is literally sculpting itself based on what the child encounters.
The three pillars, gross motor, fine motor, and social communicative, are all being sculpted simultaneously, but on slightly different timelines.
Gross motor is the most visible, cruising, standing independently, first tentative steps. Fine motor is the quiet revolution, pincer grasp refinement, precise object manipulation. And social communicative is the one parents find most mysterious. Joint attention, social referencing, first words, the emergence of pointing.
All three converge in this 8-week window. Before 10 months, these systems develop in parallel, but don't really talk to each other. After 10 months, they integrate.
That's the phase transition. The 6 to 9-month-old can sit, reach, babble, but these are isolated skills. The 10-month-old starts combining them. He sees a toy across the room, cruises to it, picks it up with a pincer grasp, and looks back at the parent to share the achievement. That sequence, perceive, plan, execute, share, requires integration across motor, cognitive, and social systems. That's what wasn't happening before.
The gender angle complicates how parents experience this. Boys 3 to 4 weeks ahead on gross motor, 4 to 6 weeks behind on language. But the variance within sexes is larger than the difference between them.
That's the crucial point that gets lost, and all the boys are like this, girls are like that. Parenting content. If you take 100 boys and 100 girls at 12 months, the distributions overlap massively. You'll find boys with 20 words and girls who aren't walking yet. The averages are real. They show up consistently across studies and cultures, but they're not predictive for any individual child.
The parent worried because their 12-month-old boy isn't talking yet needs to hear two things. One, the average difference exists and it's biologically grounded. It's not a failure of parenting. Two, the range of normal is so wide that a quiet 12-month-old boy is still almost certainly within it.
Acknowledge the patterns without turning them into prescriptions. The biology is interesting and worth understanding. It's not destiny.
Let's talk about pointing, because that's where motor development and communication intersect. The parent counting vocabulary at 12 months might not be watching for pointing at 11 months, but pointing is actually the more important signal.
The pointing gap is one of the most replicated findings in this literature. At 11 months, boys point significantly less than girls, fewer instances per hour, fewer distinct objects pointed at. But by 14 months, the gap closes completely. The boys catch up.
The worried parent at the 12-month checkup sees a boy who isn't pointing much and isn't saying many words, and concludes there's a language problem, when really the system is on a slightly different schedule.
Here's the key insight. Pointing is not language. Pointing is a proxy for shared intentionality, the drive to share attention with another person. It's a social cognitive skill that precedes and enables language, but it's not the same thing. A child can have robust, shared intentionality and still be a late talker. The pointing tells you the social foundation is there. The words will come.
Absence of pointing at 14 months is more concerning than absence of words at 12 months.
If a child isn't pointing at all by 14 months, not to request, not to share interest, not to show, that's worth investigating regardless of vocabulary. But at 11 months, especially for boys, low pointing is typically just timing. Now, on the language side directly, the vocabulary spurt is where gender differences become most visible and most contentious.
Where the measurement problem gets tricky. Boys average 3 to 6 words at 12 months versus 6 to 10 for girls. How do we even count a word at that age?
A word at 12 months is any consistent sound pattern used to refer to something specific, even if pronunciation is approximate. Ba for ball counts, but only if used consistently and intentionally. Babbling, ba-ba-ba, while playing with blocks doesn't. The measurement requires parent report, which introduces bias. Some parents are generous coders. Some are conservative.
Part of the reported gap might be that parents of boys are less likely to interpret ambiguous vocalizations as words.
A 2022 University of Washington study found that with objective coding, trained observers watching video, the gender gap in early vocabulary shrinks by about 30% compared to parent report. Parents of girls were more likely to credit a sound as a word, but the gap doesn't disappear entirely. Even with objective coding, there's still a real difference of about 2 to 3 words on average at 12 months.
The measurement artifact is real, but it's not the whole story.
The biology matters too. The 2024 Max Planck Institute study measured prenatal testosterone from amniotic fluid samples and followed children longitudinally. At 12 months, higher prenatal testosterone correlated with reduced left hemisphere lateralization for language processing. In most people, language is left lateralized. Broca's area, Wernicke's area, all on the left. But high testosterone infants showed more bilateral or right hemisphere activation during language tasks.
Which sounds like a deficit if you assume left lateralization is the only correct way to process language.
That assumption is wrong. Bilateral language processing is a different strategy, not a broken one. By age 4 or 5, these children have caught up in vocabulary and grammar. They took a different neural route. The testosterone effect seems to delay left hemisphere specialization without impairing the ultimate outcome.
The parent of a quiet 12-month-old boy should hear, the language system is probably building itself bilaterally, which takes a little longer, but the destination is the same.
There's another layer. When girls in this age range start talking, they tend toward a referential style, labeling objects. Boys tend toward an expressive style, holistic phrases or social routines. These are harder to count as individual words, but they're linguistically sophisticated. An expressive phrase requires understanding of social context and communicative intent, not just object label mapping.
The counting method is biased toward the referential style. If a girl says dog and cup, that's 2 words. If a boy says all gone and uh-oh, those might get coded as 1 word each or not at all.
The standardized vocabulary checklists, the MacArthur-Bates CDI, the gold standard, has been criticized for exactly this. It's weighted toward nouns. Expressive phrases are harder to capture. So we're measuring language through a referential lens and concluding boys are behind. It's not wrong exactly, but it's incomplete.
What about the screen time effect?
The 2025 JAMA pediatric study found that for every 30 minutes of daily screen time at 10 months, the child had about 4 fewer words at 12 months. The effect was stronger for boys. The likely mechanism is displacement. Screen time replaces the serve and return interactions that drive language development. And because parents tend to talk more to infant girls, which is well documented, the displacement hits boys harder.
Lower baseline exposure plus testosterone, mediated bilateral processing plus a measurement system that favors referential vocabulary. The gap is overdetermined.
Yet none of this means there's a problem. The vast majority of these boys will have perfectly normal language by age 2 or 3. The range of normal is wide enough to accommodate all of this variation. The danger is parents pathologizing a normal trajectory and starting interventions that create anxiety without providing benefit.
Let's talk about joint attention, the critical precursor to language. You mentioned boys show a 2 to 3 week delay on average.
Joint attention is the ability to follow someone else's gaze to an object or to initiate shared attention by looking at an object and then back at the person. It typically emerges between 9 and 12 months. The correlation with vocabulary at 18 months is about 0.52, which is substantial in developmental psychology. It's one of the strongest single predictors we have.
It's not just about following gaze. It's about understanding that the other person has a mind that can be directed toward something.
Joint attention is the behavioral marker that the infant is beginning to understand other people as intentional agents. This is the foundation for theory of mind, understanding that other people have beliefs, desires, and perspectives that differ from your own, and it emerges right in this window. So the question becomes, what do you actually do with this information if you're a parent in the thick of it?
Because knowing your 10-month-old's brain is rewiring at a synaptic level doesn't help much at 2 in the morning, when they won't sleep, and their only communication strategy is screaming.
let's start with the most actionable thing. 10 minutes a day of what developmental psychologists call serve and return interaction. No toys, no screens, no distractions. Just you and the child face to face responding to each other.
Serve and return, like tennis.
The baby serves. A sound, a gesture, a facial expression, a point. The parent returns. A matching sound, an exaggerated facial response, naming what the baby is looking at. Then the baby serves again. 10 minutes of this, every day, specifically targets joint attention and language readiness. It's not about teaching words. It's about teaching the child that communication has a structure. I do something, you respond, I respond to your response. That's the fundamental architecture of conversation.
10 minutes is specific. Not talk to your baby more, which is the vague advice that makes parents feel guilty without giving them anything to do.
10 minutes is research grounded. Longer sessions lose the baby's attention. Shorter sessions don't give enough practice cycles. And the no toys rule is important because toys become the focus of joint attention rather than the parent-child dyad itself. You want the interaction to be the activity.
What about the parent who says, I don't have 10 uninterrupted minutes?
Then do 2 5-minute sessions, or 3 3-minute sessions. The total matters more than the continuity. And serve and return can happen during caregiving routines. Diaper changes, feeding, bath time, these are already face-to-face moments. You just add the intentional back and forth.
The advice isn't add another thing to your day. It's convert existing FaceTime into interactive FaceTime.
On the motor side, the best intervention is equally simple. Floor time with obstacles. Not tummy time, we're past that at 10 months. We're talking about a safe floor area populated with cushions, cardboard boxes, low sturdy furniture. Things the child has to navigate around, over, or through.
The obstacle course as developmental tool.
The key is that obstacles create what roboticists call a non-trivial environment. A flat open floor is trivial. The baby crawls or cruises in a straight line, no problem, solving required. Add a cushion, and suddenly there's a decision. Go around it, go over it, push it aside. Each choice generates a different motor plan, and each outcome updates the internal model. The brain is learning to solve movement problems, not just execute movement patterns.
The thing to avoid?
The sit-in kind with wheels. Canada banned them in 2004, and the data is solid. Walkers don't help babies learn to walk. They delay independent walking by 2 to 3 weeks on average. They also cause injuries. Thousands of ER visits per year, mostly from falls downstairs, the walker enables by giving the baby access to places they couldn't reach on their own.
The walker creates an illusion of mobility without the underlying motor competence. The baby moves through space without learning to balance, without building core strength, without calibrating the vestibular system.
When you take the walker away, the baby has to unlearn the incorrect motor patterns. Push toys. The kind the child stands behind and pushes. Those are fine. The child supports their own weight, practices balance, and controls the speed. That's real practice.
Floor time with obstacles, no walkers, 10 minutes of serve and return. What about tracking milestones? Parents are drowning in apps and checklists.
The CDC's Milestone Moments app, updated in 2024, is the one to use. It's free, based on the largest normative datasets, and organizes milestones by age in the usable way. But here's the crucial instruction the app doesn't give you. Ignore the red flag alerts unless your child is missing multiple milestones across multiple domains.
That's counterintuitive. The app flags something red. The parent's instinct is to panic.
That instinct is wrong. A single domain delay, say language only or motor only, is typically normal variation. The developing brain doesn't advance uniformly across all systems. During a motor explosion, language might temporarily plateau. During a language spurt, motor progress might stall. This is normal resource allocation, not pathology. The red flag becomes meaningful when you see delays across 2 or more domains, motor and language, or motor and social. That pattern warrants a conversation with the pediatrician.
The app is useful, but you have to use it with a mental filter that the app itself doesn't provide.
The app is designed for sensitivity over specificity. It catches everything so nothing gets missed. That's appropriate from a public health perspective, but from a parental anxiety perspective, it generates false positives. Knowing that going in changes how you interpret the alerts.
There's one more thing I want to land that ties together everything about autonomy and exploration. The concept of a yes space.
This sounds like parenting philosophy, but is grounded in motor learning research. A yes space is a completely child-proofed area, a room or gated section, where the child can explore freely without hearing no or don't touch. No electrical outlets, no sharp corners, no fragile objects. Just safe surfaces and safe objects.
The point isn't just safety. Constant interruption disrupts the motor learning loop. Every time a parent says no and physically redirects, the motor plan being executed gets aborted. The learning cycle breaks.
There's also a social cognitive cost. If every exploration ends with parental intervention, the child learns that exploration leads to negative feedback. The yes space reverses that. Exploration leads to discovery, which leads to satisfaction, which motivates more exploration. It's a positive feedback loop for autonomy.
For the parent, it reduces the cognitive load of constant vigilance. You can sit in the yes space and observe without intervening. That's qualitatively different from following a mobile 10-month-old around a non-child-proofed house, which is essentially a continuous low-grade stress response.
The practical version, a gated play area with a few low boxes, soft cushions, and a small selection of safe objects. Wooden spoons, stacking cups, fabric balls. Nothing that does the playing for the child. The environment is the curriculum. The child's own motor curiosity drives the learning. You're just the witness and occasional serve and return partner.
To pull it all together, 10 minutes of serve and return, floor time with obstacles, no walkers, CDC app with a mental filter for red flags, and a yes space that lets the child explore without interruption. That's the practical toolkit for the 10 to 12 month window.
The unifying principle, create conditions for the child's own developmental systems to do their work. You're not building the brain is building itself. You're just making sure the construction site has the right materials and nobody's knocking down the scaffolding.
Here's the question I keep coming back to. We've laid out this toolkit, but there's a wave of technology about to crash into exactly this space. The Owlet Dream Lab launches next month. AI-powered baby monitors that don't just track breathing, they promise to track developmental progress. All fed through machine learning models that compare your baby to normative curves in real time.
The sales pitch is seductive. Never miss a developmental delay. Data-driven parenting. The Dream Lab uses computer vision to analyze movement quality, smoothness, variability, symmetry. It flags deviations automatically.
Which sounds like a public health win, until you remember what we just said about the CDC app. The app flags everything, and parents have to mentally filter it. Now imagine a device that flags everything, 24/7, with push notifications.
The false positive problem gets amplified by orders of magnitude. A baby has an off day, tired, fighting off a mild virus, consolidating a different skill, and the app says movement variability below threshold. What does the parent do with that? The device has no context. It doesn't know the baby spent the previous day intensely practicing cruising and is now integrating that learning during a quieter day.
The data is real, but the interpretation is absent. And interpretation is what pediatricians spend years learning.
There's a deeper tension the tech industry hasn't reckoned with. Developmental intuition. The parent's gut sense that something is or isn't right is a real cognitive faculty. It's pattern recognition built on thousands of hours of observation. When you replace that with a dashboard, you might be trading a noisy but high bandwidth signal for a clean but low bandwidth one.
The dashboard tells you one number. The parent's intuition integrates facial expression, body tone, eye contact, emotional state, context, history. The number is precise but thin. The intuition is messy but rich.
We know from other domains that combining algorithmic outputs with expert human judgment outperforms either alone. The danger is when the algorithm replaces the judgment rather than augmenting it. Parents who trust the app more than their own eyes.
The question isn't whether these devices are accurate. It's whether parents can hold them lightly. Use the data as a second opinion, not a first authority.
Which brings me to something exciting in a completely different direction. The microbiome gut-brain axis. Stanford published early results this year showing specific strains of gut bacteria correlate with motor milestone timing in infants. Not causation yet, it's observational. But the correlations are striking enough that they're running intervention trials.
Gut bacteria influencing when a baby walks?
The proposed mechanism is through neurotransmitter precursors. Certain bacteria produce compounds that cross the blood-brain barrier and influence myelination. The corticospinal tract we talked about, the one that myelinates during this exact 10 to 12 month window. If the gut is producing the right precursor molecules at the right time, myelination proceeds on schedule. If not, it might lag.
The motor explosion we've spent this whole episode describing might be partly orchestrated by the microbial ecosystem in the baby's intestines.
Which is humbling. We've been talking about the cerebellum, the motor cortex, the social brain, and now it turns out the gut might be running part of the show. The Stanford group found infants with higher levels of specific Bifidobacterium strains hit sitting and crawling milestones earlier. It's early, it's messy, but it's real.
It reframes the parental role yet again. You're not just creating the right physical and social environment. You might be indirectly shaping neural development through what you feed the child, through antibiotic use decisions, through things we don't fully understand yet.
That's where I want to land this. Because the temptation with all this information, the milestones, the mechanisms, the microbiome, the AI monitors, is to try to optimize, to treat development like an engineering problem with inputs and outputs. But the biology doesn't work that way. Development is robust. It's designed to work across an enormous range of environments, inputs, and timelines. The 9-month walker and the 17-month walker both get there. The 3-word 12-month-old and the 30-word 12-month-old both learn to talk.
The range is the point.
The range is the point. And our job, as parents, as pediatricians, as a culture, is to hold that range without pathologizing the edges. To offer support without demanding performance. To create conditions for growth without measuring every leaf as it unfurls.
Which is harder than optimizing. Optimization gives you a checklist. Trusting the range gives you uncertainty.
Uncertainty is the actual condition of parenthood. Always has been. The tech just makes it feel optional.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
I'm almost afraid to ask.
In the late Victorian period, a British telegraph operator stationed in Kiribati discovered a previously unknown Gilbertese script carved into the wooden casing of an abandoned signal station, a syllabary that had been lost for at least 2 generations and was never recorded anywhere else. The carvings were destroyed when the station was dismantled in 1891, and no transcription survives.
An entire writing system gone. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, we're at myweirdprompts.newepisodes every week. Go hug your 10-month-old and maybe don't buy the AI monitor just yet.
Or at least wait for the reviews.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.